Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Hey, everybody, welcome to episode 376 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm pleased to be joined by Martin Woodward in near Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Yes, yeah, sunny Northern Ireland.
Another sunny. Is it sunny there today?
No, it's dark at the minute. It rarely is sunny, but yeah, it's always funny.
Yeah. Well, I got to go to Dublin finally. I have Irish relatives. My grandmother was Irish, and my wife's family, her mother was Irish, and we finally got to go. We went to Dublin, and they're from Kerry, so we went down, you know, all the way down to Kerry and back again. Yeah, it's pretty cool. But I've never even thought about going up to Belfast, but I guess it's something that we could eventually do at some point.
Yeah, it's a beautiful part of the world. The north coast of Northern Ireland is one of my favorite places in the world to be. It's absolutely gorgeous. Yeah.
And are you originally from Ireland or?
No, originally from England. And then when I met my girlfriend, now wife, when I was at university in England, and then we moved back here when we had kids. So yeah, it's a great part of the world to bring up a family. And, you know, as long as you can earn money through the internet, then it's a great part of the world to live as well. So I live in a field in the middle of rural Northern Ireland, but I have like gigabit fiber and things. So infrastructure out here is really good. So it's great.
Yeah, as long as you got the good internet, that's good. Yeah, I mean, I pretty much have been joking for the last 20 years, anywhere where my laptop is where my office is, kind of thing, right? So although I've worked for companies for periods of time. Cool. So for those of the people who don't probably know who you are and what you do, we should tell people that you're working for GitHub. But can you tell us a little bit about your role there, and we'll get into how you got there later.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm Martin Woodward. I'm the VP of Developer Relations at GitHub. So that sounds like a fancy title, but basically I help people, you know, build delightful things with GitHub, and I try and go out and talk to lots of people, especially in the open source community, who are building on top of GitHub, help make sure they're getting the most out of the platform, and then also bring their feedback back into the engineering teams. A large part of my job is actually helping make sure we make GitHub better for developers, and that we're, you know, continuously improving. And so yeah, that's kind of what I do. It's a dream job, to be honest, because, you know, where else do you want to do that kind of work but at GitHub? And the impact you get to have is just amazing. So yeah, I love it.
So developer relations is a relatively a new term. I mean, I was doing what I would call technical sales support back in the 2000s. And that's, I think it was very similar. I was sort of helping people understand their Macs and how to use them to do work and that kind of thing. And that was before my development days. But so can you sort of give our listeners a little idea what a developer relations role is and how you get to be one and all the kind of cool things you get to do.
Yeah, it is kind of newer. The key thing is you don't have any quotas or anything like that. We are out there, you know, purely kind of helping to educate is a large part. So helping people understand how things work. So if you're at WWDC, all those amazing videos that they do and all the content that's created by the developer relations team at Apple largely. And they're working with people who are in the engineering teams to find out what's being built and all, how it all makes sense. And then you try and take all that raw information from the engineering teams and sort of stitch it together into something coherent for normal developers to understand. And so it helps that I'm not particularly bright, because if I can make it, you know, make sense to me, then it'll make sense to most people. Make the story, make it make sense, explain that to people, and then bring the information back. That's the part of developer relations you tend to see, which is the role specifically within developer relations is developer advocacy, where you're doing that kind of where you're advocating for the needs of developers and then helping also developers understand your product. So that's quite typical. And then there are other roles within developer relations as well. So we run programs so we can do this kind of work at scale, you know, in terms of helping open source communities be successful, talking to our top open source communities, making sure they've got everything they need, almost being, you know, like you were doing technical sort of support with people, you know, like helping make sure they were successful. We do the same kind of thing for our open source people, because they're not generating revenue. They don't pay for GitHub, but right, they still need somebody who can kind of be their account manager and kind of help them have that relationship with the business. And so we fulfill that role. And then we have things like we have kind of the GitHub stars, which are our, you know, top people on GitHub who are out there helping the community, educating, things like that. We run that program as well as a few others. So, yeah, it's kind of, there's the programmatic side that you don't really notice. And then there's the advocacy side where you go up on stage and you give talks and you do YouTube videos and you come on podcasts and things like that. So it's a mix of both. Helps to be an introvert as well. It's like an introvert who can pretend to be an extrovert. That's almost like the perfect DevRel person. So,
yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah, cool. So Git is kind of an important thing. I mean, in general, from a version control point of view, I suppose it's kind of won the day in terms of, I don't know where it sits in terms of compared to other version control tools out there. But I think the majority, I mean, it's tied into Xcode, you know, it's tied into VS Code, whatever your tool of choice, even Android Studio, I guess. So Git plays an important role in everybody's lives, and whether they know it or not. I mean, I don't know if that every engineer is using version control specifically, but I know that like a lot of it drives me crazy. A lot of tutorials you watch online, they don't say, and make sure that Git checkbox is ticked, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a great way to keep track of, you know, if you're learning, keep track of the stages of what you're doing and that kind of stuff. So can you tell a little bit about the kind of role that Git has in a developer's life, whether they're iOS or web or React or whatever?
So source control is important, especially when you start working in a team of more than one. Ideally, if you were in a team of one as well, you'd be constantly doing checkpoints and versioning and making sure you can roll back. Oftentimes when we start out as lone developers, we do that by kind of taking a folder and, you know, compressing it and then storing it somewhere else and then bringing it back again, you know, so we've got checkpoints. A version control system allows you to do that and make regular checkpoints over time. Within Xcode, I'm not sure if it still supports SVN, but for a long time, two version control systems were supported in Xcode. It was Git or Subversion was the old one. And there were two different types of version control system. The vast majority, over 90% of developers now use Git as source control. The only place where you might not be using Git as your source control system nowadays is probably in the sort of AAA gaming studio communities, where you've got very, very, very high sort of binary files. Git isn't awesome at doing that. At GitHub, we have some workarounds for this, but using anything called Git LFS for large file support. But Git out of the box kind of doesn't do great with large binaries, and that's why the gaming studios tend to use other things. But for the vast majority of developers, most iOS developers, Git is probably the right version control system. And then GitHub builds a set of services for you to host and for you to store your Git version control system, because Git is just an open source system that anybody can use.
Right.
And then you can publish your repository, you can store it with GitHub. And then that then allows you to very easily share that repository with anybody in the world. And it also allows you to collaborate on it. So to track your issues, to do your builds, and maybe automate your builds as well. So now, rather than building your iOS app, you know, just locally in Xcode, you can actually build it on servers that we host for you. And you can even publish that, you know, you can do all the testing and then publish that to the App Store, all from these servers, and have all that automated. And that's kind of what teams do. That's how they build that stuff.
That's an interesting segue. I guess the kind of CI/CD is the idea there. So can you talk, what's the name of the product, and can you talk a little bit about the...
Yeah, so GitHub has a service called GitHub Actions, and that's hosted CI/CD. It's hosted automation. It can actually do more than just builds. It can automate everything. Typically, people use it when they're doing a build process. So say you would take your... iOS build, and you know, you an Xcode build to build it kind of thing. You can do that on a server in the cloud that you have instant access to, that you can always run it, always do it, and then you can then you know, build, deploy, and deploy out to the App Store as well as test.
So multiple teams, like if you run a team with multiple engineers, you know, they could create a PR. And then you could have it automated that when the PR has been accepted, it does a build, and then...
Yeah, so exactly that. So you can, to get started, what you do as a sort of small team typically is the moment that you push your code to GitHub, then a build runs automatically, creates you a version of your binary, mm-hmm. and then has it available for you to... you know, to put into test flight, to be able to then get it on your app to test. And so you automate that entire process. So basically, you know, you're constantly getting updates that you can then load in via test flight into your devices locally. That you would do on the main branch. So the main, and that's the one where everybody's integrating into. As you then work as a team, you typically create a feature inside of a feature branch that's just isolated to the thing you're doing. So maybe you're adding a high score table, or maybe you're adding, you know, sharing functionality, whatever it is that you're adding. You do that, and then you get it to a point where it's good. And that is now a point of review. So your entire team can now look at that change in isolation and say, hey, is this good or not? You can look at the diffs between your current feature branch and the main branch that you've currently deployed, see what's changing, and then you can do a code review on that. But as you said, Tim, as part of that, you can have an automatic build happening on that feature branch as well. So then you can very easily, you know, look at your unit tests, look at your UI tests, if you've done some UI testing as well, look at those results before you then decide if you want to merge that into the main branch. And then from the main branch is where you do your automatic deployments out to the App Store and things. So,
and presumably you can also tie it into like a QA system to have like an Appium or whatever, so QA can get do their things.
Exactly. The QA team can pull it down. You can have it set up so, you know, you have different branches that like things get deployed to test flight from, or wherever, or whatever you want to do to, you know, as a way of doing the QA stuff. So, yeah, that's typically how it's set up for most people.
At the risk of mentioning a competitor, I guess, maybe a strong one, I guess, eventually. Xcode Cloud, I mean, I played around with that last year, where you basically, same sort of idea, you tie your builds into a cloud, I forget what the term is, but it'll come to me in a minute, lane, I guess. And when you do your command B build, it goes out to Xcode Cloud, does the whole thing, and then actually publishes out to the test light store and then notifies internal testers or external testers based on how you have it set up. So is that something that you can do the same? Can you, I presume you can always, you've always been able to do that with GitHub Actions, right?
You've always been able to do that with GitHub Actions, and then you can do that. Again, you can do that for iOS apps, but you can do that for all apps. So you can do that for your Mac apps. You can do that for
Android,
Windows, for deploying to AWS, deploying to the cloud, whatever. You can build everything within Actions, and we actually have. You can bring your own runners. So if you wanted to run something on your fancy, Macs at home, you can actually run those on your own Macs. But we provide for you a set of Macs for you to build on. And we have, a big sort of pool of Macs for you to go build. We had Intel Macs for the longest time. And then just recently, actually, we've made available M1 runners where, so it's basic. We can dig into a bit more if you want, but it's a whole heap of rack mounted M1s and Mac minis that are in the cloud. And, you as a developer, you don't care. You just say, run this on a, 6-core Apple Silicon machine for me, please. And it will find a spare computer for you. It will run that build, give you the results, do all the unit tests, maybe run all the UI tests for you, do all the compilation things, get you the binaries ready to deploy, and then it throws that build server back into our pool. Then we completely delete the image, re-image it, bring it back up again, and put it back into the pool for the next person to do another clean build. So we kind of take care of all that for you, which is pretty neat.
So I just want to interject here, just in case people were wondering, This episode is not sponsored by GitHub. I'm just curious, Martin.
Sorry, yeah,
approached
yeah.
me. Yeah, I just want to make sure that, because my next question is going to be, so how can you explain to people like myself, GitHub Actions and the build system, are there pricing tiers? How does it, like, I'm an independent engineer right now, but yeah. I've been on Teams before, and Teams are obviously interested in this. So how do you tier the offerings? And if I wanted to go from like an M1 to M3, can you sort of cover between GitHub Actions and I forget what the name of the build service system is, how that works?
GitHub Actions is the build system. Yeah.
Okay.
So you will get access to a number of free minutes that you can have access to. And that's enough to, go experiment and play and go build things and make sure it's working for you. If you want access to larger, more powerful machines, if you want access to the Apple Silicon-based machines, there you pay per minute as an independent, or you can you pay per minute is how it works, and it's I would need to look. It's like fractions of a cent per minute is how it kind of is built out,
right?
And then it's just like any kind of cloud infrastructure. I'll go grab the exact numbers for you as to what that is, but that's how it works. It's like a per minute billing thing. But the advantage as well is you only pay for usage. So if you don't have to go, but you can get access to as many build machines as you want instantly. So if you're doing lots of builds or then that's quite good. And a lot of teams love it as well, because they can, especially if you're doing like a cross-platform app and you're building an Android version and Apple Silicon version or an iPhone version, you can go do that and go get instant access to these machines without having to go buy all the hardware.
And there's no monthly commitment. Like, you don't have to buy a certain number or block of time and then lose it if you don't use it.
Exactly. Cool.
But we can get to the prices later. That's fine.
I'm not a sales guy, unfortunately.
You mentioned that earlier. No quotas and all that kind of stuff, which is great.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just trying to find it right now as we speak, but I'll do it. Especially for the M1s.
Yeah.
Because so the free runners that we have, they are that if you were using one of the free runners, it's a 3 or 4 core CPU, like Intel, you know, Mac Mini kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be what you get access to for free. If you want one of like the 12 core machines, so if you want a whole, you know, trash can Mac Pro, then I think that's 12 cents per minute or something. And then, yeah, here it is, 12 cents per minute. And then an M1, which is like, what, a 6 core, Apple Silicon, that is 16 cents per minute is what that's kind of billed at. So we do iOS applications here at GitHub, and we went from a 12 core Linux box, that we had a 12 core Intel box, sorry, it was a 12 core macOS box, of course it was. So the Mac, you know, a big trash can Mac Pro. We went from that to a 6 core M1 runner, and our build times dropped from, I think it was 42 minutes was what we originally were built. That's what our build time was. And then it dropped to 23 minutes. Mm. And so just going to that Apple Silicon hugely increased the overall build time.
Right.
What was fascinating when we did that, though, like build compilation was like 50, 51% faster. But the unit tests actually stayed about the same. And I think that's a lot to do with kind of, you know, poor compilation is faster on the Apple Silicon machines, but then with unit tests, because they're parallelized, the advantages of having those extra cores on that 12 core machine kind of caught you up. But then with we do a lot of automated UI testing, you know, where we're taking screenshots, and then we do, you know, pixel per pixel comparisons with what our UI looks like now to see how we changed when we were building the application. And those automated UI tests, I think they were like 55% faster on Mac runners. So depends on the workload is how much faster it is. But as you know yourself, the difference between those, the Apple Silicon and the Intel Silicon running macOS, is it's always interesting what's faster and what's not.
Yeah, it also depends on how quickly you want to turn your PR around too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I worked on large teams where sometimes you're waiting an hour for a build. It's not fun, you know, on an old Jenkins machine, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's two questions that come to my mind. One is, you don't necessarily have to, are they all building on, like, if I'm doing web or something outside of the iOS Apple ecosystem?
Yeah.
Are there other build systems? Like you mentioned,
yeah, Linux. There's a Linux box you can just build on, like an Ubuntu server. And, you know,
right.
Again, there's a huge amount of free minutes you get with on the Linux builds. And then again, you can pay per minute to get a Linux build, and you can, they scale up to massive machines as well if you want. But for the average web build, a 2 or 4 core machine just works fine for you, and you just go build your website, deploy it to the cloud somewhere, and off you go. And a lot of times that's what we're doing, is we're building our applications for iOS or for Android or whatever. We build those, and then we're also building the back end service that these applications are talking to, and then that's being deployed out to the cloud, whether that's AWS, GCP, you know, Azure, whatever it is. So like you're deploying that back-end service to something. And a system like GitHub allows you to put all of that into one place. And then you have a separate repo, usually for your iOS application, a separate repo for your Android application, some stuff for your shared logic, a separate repo for some of your services. And they all build and deploy as they get changed and then ship out. And, you know, and you can compare the differences between them. So that's how.
Is there a dashboard you can use to configure all this stuff and get sort of metrics on how performance is going and things like that?
Yeah. You get all those, you know, views of deployments and things. Configuration is always done as code. So it's a YAML, yet another YAML file,
right,
where you configure. And that's stored alongside of your code. And that's very deliberately done that way inside of the Git repository. So you have repeatable builds. So if you go back in time and you want to build something you did 2 years ago, you know that your build process is also the same version as it was you were building 2 years ago, you know. So that's why we store the configuration as source, as YAML source.
And of course, it's version controlled, right?
Version controlled in Git alongside your code. So yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's everything is stored in a Git repo.
So the upcoming interesting device is the Vision Pro and Vision OS. And I've done did some writing on Vision OS and doing some working on some stuff right now. But recently, and I don't know if this is true in 15.2, which just came out a couple of days ago, Xcode 15.2, that is, all of a sudden we weren't able to use the iOS simulator on an Intel Mac. I have both Mac and M1 here.
Right.
I'm curious, so does it matter if somebody's building a Vision OS project if it runs on an Intel machine for the build server? Do you know?
I have no idea. I haven't built a Vision OS app. I haven't tried that one. So, yeah. But that feels like that's going to be an instance where you need to use the Apple Silicon because they have the GPUs enabled by default. Right. And how many, I think, on those Mac, it's like an 8-core GPU, isn't it? So I imagine that's why, for all of the magic stuff that they're doing. But I personally haven't done that.
It's just one of the questions that came to my mind.
So
just recently, I have the time right now, so I was able to attend the GitHub Universe conference a couple weeks ago online. And one of the interesting things that they talked about, and I've heard about a bit of buzz about, and of course, we were talking a bit about AI earlier.
Yeah.
GitHub Copilot. So can you talk a little bit about what GitHub Copilot is and how it could help us?
So, GitHub Copilot is an AI coding assistant for you as a developer. So it sits alongside you, acting as a copilot. You're always in control, sort of suggesting code changes as you go. It kind of has like ghost text, allows you to suggest that as you're going along. And then it also has a kind of chat-based interface as well, where you can ask it coding type questions. So, how would I do this in Swift or whatever, or how would I go write one of these things? And it can give you examples and can, use the power of sort of its different models in the back end to give you those answers. We see that typically it varies in different languages and things, but typically developers they're able to write code, I think it's like over 50% faster, 55% faster, using Copilot kind of helping them. And it really helps you with a lot of kind of like that boilerplate text and things like that. So it's been pretty amazing, and we launched that a year ago, and then we previewed in March the chat based capabilities, and then sometime towards later on this month, and we're recording in December, so towards the end of December, we're also going to be making available the chat-based capabilities. That's in preview right now, and they'll be more generally available, so you can ask those questions. So it's good, and there's lots of excitement around it, that's for sure.
Is it, just to dig in a bit, is that sitting on top of ChatGPT kind of thing? I think I read yesterday that it's using ChatGPT 4, version 4.
Yeah, it uses, there's a whole interesting conversation here to talk about like right size models and things.
Sure.
The way that it works is code completion. So when you're typing inside of an editor, you want answers back super quick.
Right.
You want very, very quick answers. And we're actually sending a prompt every time you type a keystroke, and then we cancel that out if you keep typing. But otherwise, we respond it back to you in about 200 milliseconds. That uses the GPT-3.5 Turbo model, and that's hosted. That's in we host those models inside of Azure's OpenAI service. So we host those, and then we send the connections through into GPT-3.5, the model there, and then we get the results back. And then for chat-based questions, they go via GPT-4 because GPT-4 it's a lot bigger prompt window. The responses are, it can provide you with a lot more kind of context because it's not just doing one or two lines. It's doing like answering whole questions for you. But the response window for those, if you're having a chat conversation, you're happy to wait a second or two for an answer. And so we route those to GPT-4 today. The advantage of using something like Copilot is that we're constantly looking at the best models and constantly kind of updating which models we point to for the different queries. And so you just use Copilot, and then kind of the back end models that it's using are invisible to you. And then the other thing that's different about, say, just going out to, OpenAI's ChatGPT service, when it's asking the question, the prompt that you're giving the model isn't just the question you're asking. So how do I do a sort loop in Swift or whatever? It's not just sending that question. It sends context around your editor. So it sends your current code that you're in your open editor window, and it sends like which tabs you have open, what's the extension of the file you're using. So am I typing in Swift, am I in Rust or JavaScript or whatever, sends that along, and then it tunes your answer based on those questions, so that way you get code responses that are related to the rest of the code you have around you, and so that's why that improves the acceptance rate in terms of the code substitutions, and that's how it makes it more accurate by kind of giving it more prompt, giving it more context.
Sure. And so I guess there's a question of recency too, in that I mean, I've worked with the OpenAI version of ChatGPT,
yeah.
And one of the challenges that we found is that there's a certain point in time where the model has learned up to. So how does get Copilot learn from, like, if another more experienced developer is working away, does it learn from what that person's writing? Like if I ask it a question about async await, and maybe async await just came out this year,
yeah.
And I think the model, the OpenAI model, stopped learning a couple of years ago. Is there any problem with stuff that's like the latest version of things?
Yeah. So, we are using the same, the underpinning is the same GPT-4 model. Mm-hmm. But then, as I mentioned, we can provide it with additional context as part of the prompt that we're passing in. So we're able to, we pass it in the prompts of codes that's around you. And so if somebody has examples in your code base that are using patterns the way you want it, then we'll find that. Now, in the future, what we announced as well at GitHub Universe is a thing called GitHub Copilot Enterprise,
right.
And that has in it a way of looking up questions that take additional context, and so not just what you have in your editor, but also what's around you and what it knows about the world. And so that can send into the large language model a prompt that contains additional information that's able to obtain, inside of your code base, and then also looking around at some popular open source libraries and things. So it would be really interesting to try it with some of the latest features, and sort of see what results we're getting back with, the await stuff, and see how that goes. But what we tend to do is look at, from our side, what we're very not doing is, especially for Copilot Business or Copilot Enterprise, we are not training our model on your stuff.
Right.
Very, very explicitly, because it's your code, right? So your code, so it's the model with data from that you're sending it about your code, giving you back answers. What it's not doing is, we don't retrain that model based on your code, because you don't want to, you know, then you would give your amazing IP away to other people. That's not what we want to do. So it's just the smarts it's learned from, you know, from looking around and then adding into the context of what you've passed it.
So that leads to another question. I recently came from finance, where I worked for a large Canadian bank here. And one of the things we weren't allowed to do was we weren't allowed to use online services. We didn't have iCloud. We couldn't use any sort of cloud-based service. In fact, our repos are like enterprise host. Like they're I forget what the term for it is, self-hosted or something like that. But so how do you deal with large enterprise companies that for that same reason, like IP and things like that? Are you able to host people like that and guarantee that their code is safe within your stores?
Yeah. interestingly, some of the financial institutions and some people like that, Mercado Libre is an example of a bank that's sort of in very publicly talked about their usage of it. But you've also got companies like Accenture or Infosys as well, where IP is a core part of their business, that are also using Copilot, where they're able to use it because we have this service called Copilot Business, as well as, you know, the upcoming Copilot Enterprise. And we do a few things that kind of help their compliance people. There's a thing called the Copilot Trust Center, where they go to like look this stuff up and go send it to their compliance officers. But basically, we have the ability to be able to, we have the ability to, make sure that, we say and we show, we guarantee that it's your questions are being isolated, so we're not training based on your data and all that sort of stuff. That when you actually send us the prompt, interestingly, we take that prompt, we do some intent analysis on it first to make sure you're asking us a coding question. We then send it to the appropriate model based on what type of question it is. We actually send it to that model up to 10 times, believe it or not, and get back a bunch of results. And then we run another model over those results to see which is the most likely to be secure, which is most likely to be, good and compile and things. And then we send you back the results that we believe are good. And then you can, you pick the right one that you want. And we also do some filtering where with Copilot for Business, we're comparing the answers that are generated and making sure that the code that got generated by the model is unique code, and it's not anybody else's code kind of thing. It's unique to you, and give you those results. So for somebody like a bank, interestingly, by switching on something like Copilot for Business, it means that they have control of the policies as to the code that's being generated and the code that the developers get. And so it kind of, they get control over it that way. And it's protected and it's isolated and all that sort of stuff. Because after we get that response back and we send them results, we actually throw away those queries. We don't keep that data. So they're happy from a compliance point of view. And then the more pragmatic, sensible banks also realize that by enabling this kind of tooling, they give all this power to their developers in a compliant way. And that stops their developers from opening up ChatGPT on a phone or in a window and doing something, because developers are clever. They route around failure. That's literally our job. And so if you put too many obstacles in their way, they're going to go out and like route around them. I remember when I first started, I had a real job before I worked at GitHub, and you'd go out. I remember working in places where you couldn't go to search engines and couldn't use the internet. And so we quickly routed around those things. Banks also realize that people will do that, which is why they then go and use something like Copilot for Business, so they know it's compliant.
Yeah. So coming back to the access for hobbyists versus business enterprise. So again, this Copilot is available to the average Joe to use as well.
Yeah, exactly. There's, again, I'm not a sales guy, but the Copilot for individuals, the average, you know, is just a normal developer kind of thing, doing things. That's like $10 a month per user. And then Copilot for businesses is $19 per seat, you know, per user kind of thing. And then the Copilot for enterprises is $39 per user. And then we also give Copilot for individuals away for free to maintainers of the most popular open source libraries. They get access to Copilot for free because we're GitHub. You know, we want to make sure the open source community is well supported. And importantly, and something that I'm very, very proud of, is we actually give Copilot for free to educators and to students who are, you know, verified and signed up for our service. Because it's important that this next generation of engineers that are coming up and learning how to use these tools, it's important that they learn how to use them correctly, learn when not to use them, and learn when to use them. And so that's why very proud that we actually give it for free to students, but we also give it away to their teachers as well, so they can learn how to teach computer science now in a world where you have AI coding assistants that can answer all of the leak coding questions. Like, they can just answer those. And so how do you educate people, and how do you test their level of knowledge in that world? And it requires a slightly different mindset. And so we give people access to it so they can figure that out.
Yeah, hopefully that means that lead code questions are going to come away from the interview process, because that's side of a sidebar.
I'm VP of DevRel at GitHub, which is like, you know, okay job. I have never, ever in my entire life passed a lead coding job interview.
Oh, neither have I. Yeah.
So, anyway, here we go.
I'm completely self-taught too. So, I mean, I shudder at the thought, you know.
Yeah, I always have like, yeah, I've got a degree in physics, you know. I don't like to say self-taught, because I definitely learned from reading lots of others' materials and blogs and things like that. And but a lot of, well, I learned from books mostly because I'm old. But the,
I got books behind me.
Yeah, exactly. But I've always those leak coding things always optimized for people who've done like comp sci, you know, data structure classes and all that sort of stuff. And I have never done any of that. I've just written an awful lot of code in my life. And so, it's a different kind of skill sets.
Yeah. We don't want to go down the rabbit hole of use these days, but so you did mention a little bit about how you got to where you are. And that's always a fascinating thing. I know we spend a lot of time talking about GitHub technology, but so why don't we circle back and sort of find out from you, your sort of origin story. Like, so how did you, let's start with, you know, your first exposures to computers, and how did you get into doing what you're doing?
Yeah, so my first computer was a Commodore VIC-20, and so my first kind of coding was quite low level, and typing stuff in from magazines. We didn't really have Apple IIs as much over in the UK. They didn't really. Our education sector was around this thing called like a BBC Micro was what we had commonly over here, rather than Apple IIs and things. So, but it was that kind of era, you know, of computing with tape decks and all that sort of stuff. So I got into computing that way. I also love electronics and kind of tinkering with electronics. And that's how I kind of learnt IT was from the transistor up kind of thing. And again, because I was born in the 70s, grew up in the 80s and 90s. And so I don't know how kids do it now, because I've never had to learn that much. I've always been able to follow along with the industry and just keep up and keep incrementally learning the next thing. And so that's kind of helped. And then, when I left, I did a degree in physics, was going to go be a physics teacher, and then kind of looked at the physics teachers' salaries and looked at the starting salaries for IT. And I was like, hey, why don't I try this IT thing I've been doing since I was six? Why don't I actually try that for a job? And so, got a job and did consulting, did all the usual stuff. Actually, my first job was on the mainframe, believe it or not, solving year 2000 bugs. And then did a bunch of stuff, websites and what have you. Then did a startup where I was building the Mac tooling and the Eclipse and Java tooling for a Microsoft product. around in the version control space. Did that, and then as a partner of Microsoft's, figuring this will be safe because Microsoft are never going to want to do anything with Macs, never going to want to do anything in the Java space kind of thing. But this was just as Microsoft started to change as a company and got a lot more open. And then they ended up buying that like five-person startup that we had that was involved in open source. And I went over to Microsoft and helped them kind of open source a bunch of stuff. So I created the GitHub account for Microsoft, believe it or not, back in the day in 2014. It was off my credit card for a little while. And then did help them open source a thing called .NET and get that running on the Mac and get that running cross-platform. And then, yeah, and then when GitHub came up as... I was already closely involved, you know, from my relationship with them, and so I was involved in the acquisition and then came over after Microsoft had acquired GitHub. And I feel at home now because GitHub culture definitely very aligns with where I was the oddball at Microsoft, because I was kind of the open source Mac kind of Java-y guy sat in the field in the middle of Ireland, you know. And then so at GitHub I'm just normal because everybody's remote there. Everybody's kind of got that kind of distant thing. Whereas at Microsoft, where a lot of people are based in offices in, say, Seattle or something, I was kind of a little bit odd. But I'd made my way in through acquisitions, so they kind of let me stay in my field. So that was quite nice.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, I do know. I mean, I've talked to people, iOS teams at Microsoft in the past, like. Microsoft, and I'm an Apple guy through and through, like way back from the 80s. So for a long time, Microsoft was sort of a bad word in my mind. but I always like to point out to people that Microsoft Word and Excel started on the Mac as well, right? So
exactly.
Yeah. And then, you know, I mean, there's pictures of Bill Gates with Steve Jobs back in the early days, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. And there was that infamous keynote as well, where Bill Gates came up on screen and things, and everyone was booing and stuff. So yeah, it's a different time now.
Yeah, and but there's also I guess the maybe the old guard of people like myself who, you know, see Microsoft acquiring GitHub and thinking, oh, go, and then we see them acquiring or getting involved in OpenAI.
Yeah,
and, you know, so. But it's interesting to see that Microsoft is kind of resurging in the sense that from that point of view, in terms of the, where they're going, we joke about the Microsoft phone back in the day, the Windows phone, and, you know, and the Zune, of course, you know, but Apple has its own series of road apples as well, as we call them, right? Products.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Apple socks and things and the Apple Hi-Fi and all that sort of stuff. But I think what's been fascinating is that they haven't tried to mess with GitHub, you know, that they've kept it. Like they understood what was unique about GitHub and the community around GitHub, and very deliberately left that alone and supported it with resources. Sure. You know, I think things like Copilot and some of the actions stuff as well would not have happened without the resources that Microsoft are able to bring to bear. But let the community be, leave the community, keep what's unique about GitHub and just let that stay isolated from the rest of Microsoft. And that's you know, the cultures of GitHub is, you know, very similar to what it was pre-acquisition kind of thing. And so that's one of the things I just love about working here, you know, and that kind of stuff. But as you said, there's lots of iOS development that happens at Microsoft. Funny enough, one of the teams I was involved in the early days was, you know, what became .NET Core, building out a lot of the Mac, you know, machines and all that sort of stuff. So even, you know, I used to rock up in the Windows building with my MacBook kind of thing, and wondered why people were looking at me a bit strange. But but even then, I was still able to work perfectly fine. You know, it worked just great over there. So yeah, it's good. But I'm happier here now. I do like it here.
Yeah. So we talked about Microsoft. Let's talk about Apple. What do you think? I always like to ask people, in terms of where the puck is going, like, what do you think about what Apple's been doing these days in terms of their hardware and the promise of the Vision OS and spatial computing? And how do you think Apple's doing?
The Apple silicon is just absolutely mind-blowing, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
Like, the power of that hardware, and the fact that, you know, you've got so many GPUs on that chip as well. And from my side, you know, the power of what those GPUs are able to do in terms of machine learning workloads on the client is just phenomenal, as well as, you know, some of the stuff with VisionOS and things like that. I personally am probably less involved in some of the VisionOS side, although of the kind of augmented reality frameworks and things, like the Apple stuff works far better than anything I've ever seen in my life. Like, it actually is usable. And as a developer, it's like, oh, okay, this, I can see how this can work. But I'm probably still, I don't know, I haven't personally had the kind of moment yet with something like Copilot, you know, like using AI technology for coding. I was incredibly skeptical because I was like, oh yeah, yeah, buzzword, whatever. And then started to use it. And then I was, oh, this actually works. And probably because I'm, you know, we were saying like I'm self-taught, I know how to code, but don't always know how to code in every single language. Like, I, you know, I know a bit of .NET, I know a bit of Java, I know a bit of Python. I don't know a lot of Swift, you know. All those NS prefix things always used to put me off when I was doing, you know, old school Mac development. But I knew how to code. And so using a tool like Copilot is amazing for me because I can tell it kind of what I want to do because I can understand programmatic thinking, and it works great. I haven't yet had that moment with the VisionOS stuff where it's like, oh, this is solving a problem I've got and doing it in a way that only it could do, and this is a unique, amazing thing for me. So we'll see.
Yeah, my advice to anybody who's thinking about it is, if you have a chance to go to the developer lab, do it. I mean, I went in August, and I not allowed to talk about much about it right now, but. But yeah, it was, my life has changed because of it.
Right, really? Seriously?
Yeah. I mean, same thing with the iPhone was another turning point, and the Mac in general was another turning point for me. But yeah, I think VisionOS and spatial computing is going to be something else that you know,
really?
Once people really experience it, they'll get it.
Right. I think that's it, isn't it? I think, again, it's again like with Copilot, you're skeptical until you've tried it. I think you actually have to use it. I think, oh, I see. You know, it's same with the, I think it was the same with the iPad, actually. I remember seeing the iPad launch. I was like, nah, I've used tablet computers. Like, I don't get it. And then when you actually use it, you're like, oh, okay, this is, I see why I want one of these.
So, yeah, I came from print and publishing. So, you know, large format was sort of our thing, right? And so the iPad was what got me into development, because iOS development specifically, because I had a client who wanted to be on the iPad right from the get-go. So, you know, and happily, I mean, yeah, iPad is, for the longest time, the iPad was my favorite platform to work on in all of these things from Apple. But I just want to take a quick sidebar here, because just for the audience that are wondering, like, so I don't know if many developers know this, so this is a little bit of soapbox for me, but sometimes when I'm working in Xcode, I get stuck. I might open up BBEdit and I'll do a diff in BBEdit, because you can do a nice, it has a nicer tool there. I'm trying to figure out where I went wrong, where did I miss that comma or the comma or the colon or the close brace. I can sometimes figure those things out using BBEdit, but I also sometimes open up VS Code to work. I do web work in VS Code. I do some plugin widgets, that kind of stuff. I'll do that there. And you can work in Swift and other languages in VS Code as well as Docker and Dart and all that stuff. If you're doing Flutter, you might do it in VS Code. And the demos I've seen of Copilot are running in VS Code.
Yeah.
So I just want to point out that I did find the other day, because I was curious, how does this interface with Xcode is the question that I think everybody listening may be begging. And what I found was that there's a gentleman who's made a third-party plugin that allows GitHub Copilot to work in Xcode. So I don't know if you're familiar with how someone would do that, but I just wanted to point that out to the audience in case they're wondering.
Yeah, those APIs are not public yet. And so it's not, I can't guarantee how it's going to stay working. But I've definitely been impressed by that particular plugin. And then onto the, your other point there about like jump, you know, if you need to jump in to kind of, you know, do some Swift development, a top hack that I bet like less than 20% of the audience know. If you're in a GitHub repo, if you press the period key or, you know, like full stop to somebody here in the UK, it opens up VS Code in the browser on your repo.
Really?
And so if you, So if you wanted to do, or if you're in a pull request and you want to, like, you're in the middle of, and you want to like edit some files and get like a multi-file view and do some Swift development with all the color coding and all the syntax highlighting and all that sort of stuff, just press period and it, and boom, you're in a full editor with your Git repo. And then we actually even have the ability to run what's called a code space, where you get like a Linux-based container with all the back end and all of like your server-side frameworks and things like that if you want as well. But if you just want to do some simple file editing, you don't have VS Code installed, or you're on an iPad, just press that period key and you can edit away. It's pretty astounding. So yeah,
that's brilliant. That's our LinkedIn clip right there.
There we go.
We'll tune in later, folks, for that one. Cool.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So I'd like to switch gears and get into sort of the other part of the show, which I talked about, which is the questions.
Yeah.
And this is just between you and me and the rest of the world, I guess.
Okay.
It's based on the questionnaire by Marcel Proust, but I've sprinkled it in with a little bit of Stephen Colbert's questions.
Uh-oh.
Which are kind of fun, right? So we get to learn a little bit more about Martin beyond the GitHub stuff. So
beyond the nerdy stuff.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So the first question, obviously, is, this is from Marcel Proust, is what is your motto? What's your sort of elevator pitch?
I very much depends, doesn't it, on the mood you're in. So I would like to think it's be kind. Mm-hmm. But I have one at work sometimes I use, and that's which never waste a good crisis. Because crises are when, like, you know, those moments of time are when crazy things can happen, when you can innovate really, really quickly. So, yeah, a mix between be kind and then when there is stuff that happens, never waste it.
Yeah, it's good. My Irish mother-in-law used to say experience is what you get right after you needed it. it's definitely, I mean, that's how we learn everything from
it is. But you'd be amazed at like the amount of, you know, this stuff that can't happen, and yet when that was what was really interesting about what we just went through, you know, in the world and things, and all of these, you were talking about banks and stuff earlier, all these banks that couldn't move to the cloud, well, magically they could as soon as COVID happened, or they couldn't support remote working, well, now they can, you know. And similarly at work, when there's change, when there's reorganization, you know, I manage a reasonably large team, and that's one of the things I always say, is you don't waste a good crisis. If like, how can we take advantage of this and do things differently? So yeah.
Cool. So this may be an easy question for you, but what is your favorite occupation?
Favorite occupation, like favorite job or favorite thing to do?
But yeah, it's a great good twist on that question. Take it wherever you want.
I like making things because I spend my life making things in computers, so making things in 3D are always pleasurable to me. And so things like 3D printing, or like running a maker space or something like that. I think that would be running a maker space would be my favorite occupation, because then I could combine my love of like talking to people and community with building things, with helping people to build things. I think that would be good.
But you were telling me about the OctoCat behind you there earlier.
So I have a 3D printed light, which is all open source. I can give you a link for the show notes for the repo where it's all there, or you can go to one of the sites. But it's basically three. I've actually got one that I'm building for a friend for Christmas. It's sort of three components that are 3D printed, and then you have a little LEDs, and you just assemble it. It runs open source framework called WLED, which it runs it on an embedded device, and then you can have your own programmatic light that does fancy displays and all that sort of stuff, USB powered.
Well, cool. Yeah, so you can program the pattern. My wife totally wants one of those because she and the granddaughter are constantly playing with electronics.
There you go. I'll send you a link to the repo. They can go build one. It'd be a nice little project to do over the holidays as well.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw last year, there was like a Christmas tree light that came out where you could put it on the tree and you could program it to do animation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you could do that with this open source framework as well. It uses the same LEDs, like they're individually addressable RGB LEDs. But you could just buy them in a strip from, you know, Amazon or Alibaba or whatever, AliExpress, and you know they're super cheap. And so you can build it in a light like that and do whatever you want. Yeah, it's good, and it's a 3D printed model, you know, so that's good.
So apologies to the people listening to the show, but we're both makers. So now we're just going to geek out for a minute. But looking at the size of the print you got there, like I've got an Ender 3, right? So
yep.
What's the size of your printer? Is it much bigger? Or?
It's an Ender 3. It's a very deliberately, it is deliberately sized to fit on the Ender 3 print bed, which is a 22 by 22, is it something like that, print bed size. It doesn't fit on the Prusa Mini, but you can shrink it down to like 18 centimeters, which fits on the Prusa Mini. Sorry, I'm doing it in metric. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, 22 is centimeters for those.
There you go. Yeah. It's not 22 inches. That's the monster. But yeah, no. It fits on the Ender 3 because that's exactly what I printed these on. Now, I'm very jealous of the people that own like these bamboo X1Cs with all the fancy things, because I think it takes like 17 hours to print on the Ender 3, mm-hmm. whereas I'm pretty sure they can print it in like 4 hours or something.
Really?
Like
wow.
So, yeah, it's ridiculous how fast they are. And then the quality of those prints are amazing as well. So I have
I thought the speed was based on the time it takes to melt the PLA. Is that not the issue?
No. So here we go. How long have you got? So the end of the... they use, so it is, but, you know, melting PLA is easy. You just heat their head up a bit more. What is the accuracy of the XY and XY steppers, you know, when it's zooming around? And on the Ender 3, it's what's called a bed slinger. And so it's moving the thing, whereas it's moving the head. But then what they also do, which is just ridiculously amazing, and some of the modern printers can do this, before they start the print, they shake the head really, really quickly and find like the resonant frequencies and stuff. And then they have software which compensates for that. And so then when it's running the head really, really fast, so you don't get lines, and so it's super accurate, it actually compensates for the vibrations that happen at the different speeds of the print head, and kind of takes that momentum out. I always thought it was using an accelerometer or something, but I don't, you know, like from a phone, but I don't think it is. It's doing it mathematically. So yeah, it's amazing, but it is ridiculously fast. When you watch wow. it print, it looks like it's a time lapse. So that's the way to go.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, no, I've got some prints lined up that are, I mean, the Maltese Falcon behind me was probably like a 2-day print, and the Venus de Milo was a 2-day print, you know, like.
Yeah, no, it can print so fast. It's quite a bit good print volume. And if you're in the market for a bamboo X1C, if you get the AMC thing on the top, so it's got a filament swapper, and it's ridiculously good as well. Like, this is what I'm craving at the minute, one of these, and it can change the filaments for you. And so,
yeah,
if you want to do
colors for those of you driving,
if you want to, change colors, or if you want to even change materials, it's able to do that midway through the print and do that whole tricky bit about lining things up. Or if you've got lots of lots of filament of the same color, so you don't run out of filament, it can actually switch a reel of PLA midway through a print. So yeah, as well as talking about GitHub, here we go. I'm selling bamboo carbons, but never mind.
Yeah. who are not a sponsor of the show.
No, exactly.
Unless they want to be, you know, they can always sponsor.
Yeah, I'll take it.
So what's the best sandwich?
Oh. So you probably want, like, in the UK, you could either have a chip butty, which is like some chips, some fries in a sandwich with butter. That's great.
Wow.
Or it's like a sausage and bacon sandwich would be good. I think in America, I think probably the best sandwich for me in America is a club sandwich, but with no egg. I don't like egg. So I hate all American breakfast because I'm not a big fan of sugar and I'm not a big fan of eggs. And that basically seems to be what breakfast is in America. Everything else about America is amazing and wonderful and brilliant, apart from breakfast.
So in Canada, we don't put egg on our club sandwich.
Oh, there you go then. I'm having a Canadian club sandwich because your bacon's better than American bacon.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Well, actually, there's actually a company called Mr. Sub up here that they have a Canadian sub, and it's basically it's like a BLT. It's got lettuce and tomato and bacon, like the Canadian bacon, which is really nice. Canadian club
sandwich.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
Cool. Flat or sparkling?
Sparkling mostly, but that's when I'm being fancy. I do like a night, so if it's over dinner and I'm like trying to slow drinking down, then a sparkling water. Yeah,
nice. Okay, good. What's your most treasured possession?
I'm just gonna move my camera now, which is gonna be bad, but for the people who are listening, you can't see it, but back here, I have a piece, that's a piece of the original internet. So that is a piece of the 1858 Atlantic telegraph cable that ran between New York and Ireland, and then hooked into the UK. And so that was laid down and connected the two continents. It connected it briefly because they didn't quite know how electricity worked back then. And, it was an English man talking to an American. And as all Englishmen do when they're talking to foreigners, if they can't quite communicate, they just shout louder. And so the person operating the cable ended up putting thousands of volts through it and blew up the wire because that's how it worked. So then after the Civil War, they then rebuilt the connection in like the 1860s. But I've got an actual piece of that 1858 cable. When they ran it, it landed in Newfoundland, and then they took the spare cable down and Tiffany's cut it up into little segments and put a little thing around it and sold them, and I managed to get a copy of the telegraph is the original Victorian internet in my mind. It was the original because it was the first time we were able to communicate at the speed of light around the world. And that was, if you think we live in interesting times now, like that was a massive change back then.
Oh, for sure.
And also telegraph operators, they had text speak as well, and so if you're a they had the equivalent of LOL. It was actually the Morse code for HA, so H-A. But that was them laughing when they were talking to each other. The telegraph operators used to be on a big party line when they were talking to each other, and they could all like chat and listen in. It was also one of an occupation that was acceptable for women to have as well. And so it was a good way of women to earn an income outside of the home as well. So it's one of the first kind of professional jobs there. So anyway, it revolutionized things in my mind.
Well, it's almost like an IT crowd joke, Jennifer or Janet. Jennifer, is it?
Yeah.
Here's the internet, right?
In a box with a blinky light. Yeah, don't break it.
Don't break it. Yeah, we'll let you. The gods let us borrow it.
Yeah.
All right. What's the scariest animal?
A goat.
A goat.
I hate goats.
Really?
I hate goats. They got like their eyes are all evil and like evil looking. It. So I grew up in the countryside and I used to go like make dens and things with my friend, and do stuff. And there was always this one goat that would sit on a hill and like just come and stare at us kind of thing. So I think it's probably a me thing. But yeah, don't like goats. So sorry.
All right. What's your favorite action movie?
Hunt for Red October. I do like that. Or maybe Enemy of the State. That's quite a good one. The Bourne movies are good as well. A movie's a movie when you're retasking a satellite, isn't it? So that's where you get a proper movie. So
yeah. I think the one with Will Smith that you just mentioned.
Enemy of the State.
Enemy of the State. Yeah, that was sort of the first yeah, the internet is a kind of like, or the way things are connected. And I mean, you guys in the UK, they had more like street cameras than we do over here. We're getting them now here in Canada and US, but you know, you guys were, you could watch where people were going from one end of the city to the other pretty much, right?
So
that was the first time I kind of went, yeah, it's interesting. You probably could do all this kind of hacky, you know, stuff, spycraft, right?
Yeah. If only our systems were as well integrated, you know? Mm. So I think when you work in IT, you're a lot less fearful of all that stuff because you know how hard it would be to actually get it to work. But yes.
Yeah, but then by the same token, though, you use good passwords and password managers because you know you can't trust anybody, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Even the guy sitting next to you in the next cubicle.
Mm-hmm.
Who's your favorite hero of fiction?
Fiction.
Now, that can be any media you choose.
How about Ford Prefect?
Oh,
so Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was he's a hero.
Yeah,
Hitchhiker's
yeah.
Guide to the Galaxy was a very formative book as I was growing up. And so, but rather than Arthur Dent, I think probably Ford Prefect would be the one.
That's interesting. Heard. We have a Hitchhiker's Guide sort of thread going through these interviews. So we had one of the developers I talked to actually knew Douglas Adams and worked with him.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, he's a Mac user, huge Mac fan.
Mm-hmm. And the last person I spoke to, which will probably come out after this one, he chose Arthur Dent. So it's kind of interesting that
you have to introduce me to them. I could be their friend. So that would be good.
Well, you're the one that tells everybody to bring two pints with them, right? Or have two pints.
Exactly. I know where my towel is. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's all good.
Nice. That's our favorite one. What words or phrases do you overuse?
Probably things like it's kind of again Americanisms. So things like awesome or cool, mm-hmm. like because I just get excited about things a lot, and so awesome, you know, some of that probably I use too much.
I always remind people that of the Eddie Izzard piece where he talks about the use of the word awesome, like a hot dog can be awesome, and the moon landing can be awesome. So like, which is it? Is it awesome like a moon landing? Which is quite an order of magnitude more significant than a hot dog, right?
It depends how hungry you are. Sometimes a hot dog can go down really well, especially on a cold day from an outside vendor in New York. You know, that's pretty good.
I guess. Window or aisle?
It depends on the direction. So on the way out, I'll go for aisle, seat 21C. So you want exit row aisle on the way out, so you can walk mm-hmm. around. And on the way back, if you're trying to sleep, especially in coach, then a window seat, because then you can
curl up,
sleep. Plus, I have kids, and so I let them have the window seat typically, so they can see the world. Whereas I like to get up and walk around. So
nice, cool. Yeah, I guess traveling to and fro the States, it's a long flight, right?
It's a long flight. And so you, but you get to do if you take the window seat, I just sleep on the way home. Again, I have kids, and so I can sleep anywhere when I don't have something to do. And when you're flying over the North Pole, which you do from San Francisco to get here, then you don't have internet, and so you can't work. And so, I just sleep. So the window's great because then nobody disturbs you as they're going to the toilet and things.
Is there a direct flight from San Francisco to Belfast or?
To Dublin. So that's what I do. And what's even better is you clear immigration in Dublin. And so you do all the TSA stuff this side. And so when you land in San Francisco, you just get out and walk up and you just go straight out the gate like you're a domestic flight. It's amazing. I think only Canada and Ireland have that.
Yeah, I was going to say Toronto, we have that as well, which is really nice. What number am I thinking of?
42, as we've been talking about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Nope, wrong movie.
Okay.
Wrong book, wrong movie. All right. Describe the rest of your life in 5 words.
Oh. Happy. Oh, it's going to be content. Five. Wow. Happy, content. Curious. Relaxed and fascinating.
Okay, cool. What's the most used app on your phone?
Probably Overcast, maybe Chrome or Overcast. Yeah, Overcast, I think.
All right, cool. What's the one thing you own that you probably should throw out?
I probably have free shirts from old conferences that are older than my children. So yeah, I probably should get rid of some of those. But hey, you know, you don't want to get rid of them, do you?
Yeah, I've got some older than your kids too. Where is the question here? I think I might know the answer to this one, but Star Wars, Star Trek, Babylon 5, or Doctor Who?
It's not Doctor Who. It would be Star Wars for me, I think, as a franchise. Rogue One is my favorite of the Skywalker saga. You know, in that kind of, I suppose it's not a Skywalker saga. Rogue One would be my favorite, but yeah, Star Wars, I'm going to go
for. Have you seen the Andor show?
Yes. Oh, yes. And then when you watch, like, I watched Rogue One, and then you watch Andor, and then you watch Rogue One again, it's a completely different movie.
Really,
it's
yeah.
amazing. Yeah.
I have to do that. I've seen these things umpteen times. Yeah. So I do have another podcast called Spotcast where we talk. It started around Star Trek, but we also talk about Marvel and Star Wars, and Andor was far and away the best show we all enjoyed. Yeah.
It's just amazing, especially, I mean, not spoiling if anybody hasn't watched it, but the finale as well was a real tearjerker kind of thing. But yeah, it's a completely different show. And I think they're doing a couple more series, aren't they? I was hearing an interview with, who was it? Who's the guy that was in, what's his name? The one that does all the motion capture stuff normally.
Oh, Andy Serkis?
Yes. There was an interview with Andy Serkis, and I think he was talking about his character coming back. So that'll be interesting.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have you seen, like, so the director who made Rogue One just put up the creator. Did you go and see the creator in the theater?
I haven't seen that yet, but apparently it's, have you seen it?
I saw it in IMAX when it came. I knew because it was only going to be in IMAX for like a short time, because I think there was a Tom Cruise movie or Oppenheimer or something.
Yeah, whatever.
Very close. Yeah, well, so I had the afternoon and I went sat and watched it. Really enjoyed it.
It was good, was it? Because apparently it's like, because obviously Rogue One kind of burned him from being that big machine kind of thing. But apparently it's like all the stuff of the early of his work, but with a bit more budget. So yeah. Hopefully it was good.
Yeah, no, it does borrow from a lot of movies, which I guess, I mean, how do you not?
Yeah. Right.
But I thought it was a really, really interesting, visually compelling thing. The thing they did differently was rather than shooting on green screens, they actually went to Thailand, shot the scenes, and then put the CGI into those scenes, which is really interesting way
what
to
was
do
the,
it.
Was it Monsters? What was his film that he did originally? Because that's how he did his first movies, was that way.
Was he's a visual Cloverfield effect. Lane or something like that? Cloverfield?
Yeah, because he was a VFX artist originally, wasn't he? And then he came.
Cool. Yeah. Have you ever asked anybody for their autograph?
Asked anyone for their autograph? No. Because I don't like, I've got people's autographs.
Yeah.
In fact, I have the autograph of the person who helped build the telegraph cable. But I don't like to bother people when I see them in real life. I try to leave them alone, or maybe sneak a selfie of me with them in the background. But I don't like to bother them. Have you?
I have a number. I mean, I've got some. I have a signed Apple One schematic signed by Woz. I have, like, a hockey fan, so I have a Bobby Orr signature. On the wall behind me, I have a signed picture of Buzz Aldrin on the moon, signed by Buzz Aldrin.
Nice.
Speaking of awesome.
I've met Neil Armstrong. That's one of my claims to fame.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's a claim to fame. Wow, I don't have that one. But the only people I ask for autographs are when I have a book by or an album by somebody and I meet them in real life and I have the book with me, I'll get them to sign it. So I actually met Bill Atkinson at the second WWDC I went to. He was just a developer writing a photo app. And nobody knew who the old guy was. And I just walked up to him and said, can you sign my badge, please? So I have Bill Atkinson's signature. His signature's on the back of that Mac. And it's also on that. Yeah. So for those who don't know who he is, he's the guy who wrote the menu and Mac Paint and a few of the early first Mac things, right?
Yeah.
Cool. I think Well, we'll wrap it up with one last question, and that is, do you have a dream that you remember?
I'm trying to think of one that I can say in public.
Those are the boring ones.
Yeah, exactly. yes, is the short answer. The ones that always sort of amaze me the most are the ones that kind of flip and, you know, like midway through, and then you realize. One of the things that I learned was able to do as a kid early on was like realize I was dreaming and then go, I'm dreaming. Let's go do something. And so I would then go like, let's go fly and stuff like that. And then that they're the most joyous things is when, you know, when you can get up and fly and stuff. It's probably, again, if there's a psychiatrist listening, that probably says something horrific about my character, but being able to take control, realize it's a dream, and then just go do stuff you can't do in reality.
Wow, that's amazing.
Is amazing stuff. So yeah,
that's amazing. I mean, I've had the flying dreams, and I've had the dreams where I have some fantastic physical ability that is impossible, but you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've never had one where I actually realized I was in the middle of a dream. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's because you can't, you sort of, and then when you're in one of those as well, you like forcing yourself not to wake up because you know you're on like a teetering on a bridge of, if you're not careful, you might wake yourself up. And so you're like, wow. I need to keep myself asleep because I'm having so much fun.
That's very self-aware. That's interesting. I don't think I've ever spoken to anybody who's ever had that.
Really? Is that? I didn't realize that wasn't a thing. So there we go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's cool.
There'll be a name for it. There's probably some, I'll probably find it's some sort of disorder.
It's a tumor or something. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a superpower. It's like everything that's like that. Everything like that becomes a superpower, doesn't it? Like, you know, me working remotely is a superpower because I get my mornings free. And so I can do all my work in the mornings before people in the States wake up. So,
True. I did work some work for companies in California and it was in Chicago. So it was nice to have that sort of early morning, because I'd rather stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning than
I think it depends what kind of person you are. I'm a nighttime person too, and so I get up and I have my day to myself, and I can have all my meetings in the evening, and it's an amazing, it's the perfect excuse for not going to boring meetings, because I can just say, sorry, no, that one's too late, I'll pick the one I want to do instead. So yeah, it's good.
Right, cool. So yeah, so I guess that's it, we'll wrap up. So if people want to get in touch with you and find out what you're working on next, what's the best way to get a hold of you or meet up with you at a conference coming up?
If you go to github.com/MartinWoodward, that has links to all my socials on there, and you can hit me up on all of the socials. You can get me and see what I'm up to. That's probably the best way.
Yeah, we didn't talk about setting up a profile on GitHub, which I learned to do from one of my co-hosts a couple of years ago. So I've got like a picture of myself, and I have all my, you know, podcast links and obviously the repos and the contributions I've made. And yeah, so it's something that people, if you're not aware of making your own profile, check that out. That's pretty cool. That's
and
it.
You can now add different links to different socials as well. So yeah. Previously we just supported Twitter, but you know, for some reason we decided to add additional social profiles.
Like Mastodon, maybe? Yeah.
And it verifies you with Mastodon as well. It adds the metadata in. So you can add your Mastodon link and then go to your Mastodon server and add a link to your GitHub profile, and then it sets that up as verified.
Oh, that's
so that
sweet.
It is definitely you. So we have support for Mastodon.
Cool. All right. Another great use of GitHub. All right. Well, my name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra, on the socials, on the Mastodon, on the Twitter, on the Threads, also on GitHub. So until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. Please leave a comment on the website, and if you can, please write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag #AskMTJC. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is at MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. So I'm definitely going to have to dig into the... I haven't had my moments, but then again, I haven't used VisionOS. My only experience of that type of technology has been with like the HoloLens and things. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't had like the wider field of view. You know, it was good when it was like augmented reality stuff rather than fully immersed. But yeah, so we'll see. But I've got every other device, like a Quest and stuff, and mm-hmm. I played with HoloLens. But you've had the epiphany, have you?
Yeah, I have had the epiphany, and I do see the future of spatial computing that Apple's talking about. What I can say is I did go to we had an all team week thing before I was. Recently laid off, by the way, but I had an all team week thing in Chicago, and they had one of the events. They had I guess it's a Quest, so I got to try it out. They said, "What game do you want to play?" I said, "No, I just want to take me to an environment, put me in Paris, put me in escape somewhere. I want to see what this virtual experience is like because I've been doing 3D since the 90s.
Yeah,
right? I mean the 3D modeling and the stereography and all that kind of stuff, but
yeah,
and of course, obviously, all the VR and AR stuff. But it was okay. I mean, it was what I expected. I've had the Google Cardboard, and I've had that experience. I think the difference in I always like to say Apple leads from behind. So it's the quality. We're not allowed to talk about the hardware, but it's the quality.
Yeah.
Is just next level, right? From an experience point of view, I mean, it's like...
On the iPhone, how well it's like locked and how well it's doing, like it definitely is good. You know what I mean? Like the framework is. So I'm excited to see what it's like on real hardware. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And then also like using it on a plane use case actually appeals to me as well, because I have short-sightedness. I need glasses to read.
Yeah,
but I'd be able to use one of those devices for like watching movies and things while on a plane or something like that, which is I'm quite interested in that. I'm just sending you a couple of links here as well for that you might want to stick in. But yeah, there's the link to the Octa lamp, like the 3D, like the lamp I've got behind me.
Okay, yeah.
There's a link to the M1 runners, but then we've got a video that's going live in like, I'm trying to do math, probably in about 5 hours, I think, maybe 2 p.m. Okay. Pacific, I think it's going live, mm-hmm. maybe. I'm not sure. It might already be live, actually. Let's click on the link and see if it's live. Anyway, that's a video of the... Oh, yeah, it's live. Is it live? Try that link, the M1 rack video, see if that works for you, because I obviously have access because I'm publishing it.
Okay.
But it's we did a video behind the scenes of taking the M1s and rack mounting them, because we built like custom sleds for them and all sorts of things. So it's just cool as a Mac fan. It's cool to sort of see like how do you take this hardware and run it in a Mac environment, in a racked environment. For the trash cans, we had these weird like filing cabinets that we had to put them in and have all the air, because the airflow was super weird because of the like the way it works, and we had to get it to work to bring air from the hot end into the cold, you know, from the cold end into the hot end. We kind of had to do some complicated physical engineering. For this, we just took them completely out of the M1 cases and put them in our own sleds. And then, yeah, anyway, it's cool. So have a look at that video when it comes out. You'll love it.
Yeah, I didn't. It is out. I just clicked on it. But I didn't realize Christina Warren was with GitHub.
Yeah. She works on my team. Right? She works for me. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Cool. Yeah, I've been following her for years.
Yeah. She's, you could have spoken to her instead. You probably would have enjoyed it. But yeah. So, no, she's on my team. She's awesome. She's lovely. And
yeah, I've been watching her stuff online for I don't know how long. I forget where she was before Microsoft, but
yeah, she's, Yeah, journalist before that. But then she went to Microsoft, and then I hired her over into GitHub. So
okay, yeah, I knew she had made a change, but I didn't realize it was a big
change. That's why. Yeah, she comes to us.
I mean, well, see her on Twitter from time to time, or X, or whatever we're calling it this week.
She's on Threads now because they banned her from X. They've like locked her account down. Well, she can't post or do anything on X anymore. She must have, but you know, she can sometimes be a little bit spicy. So maybe she annoyed somebody. I don't know. But now, so she's on Threads mostly now. Mostly publishes there on Blue Sky, but mostly Threads. So
yeah, she doesn't pull punches, which is good. Yeah, I think probably do follow her on Threads because I've moved most of my connections from X to Mastodon, and now starting to play around with Threads a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But unfortunately, I still open X from time to time.
Yeah, I'm trying not to. I try to force myself not to put content there because I don't want to add value to the platform, kind of thing. But there's still accounts I follow that are on there, and that I'll check in occasionally. But I'm definitely finding I'm using Threads more than Twitter. So it's all good. But Overcast is definitely probably my most, like, in terms of hours, Overcast is definitely my most used app.
Do you find discovery on Overcast is helpful, useful? Because I mean, I published to Twitter because, you know, I mean, I don't know, I don't really know. Podcasting is a really hard place to get metrics on.
Yeah,
getting better. But yeah. But I post there simply because I know that I want to.
Yeah, I don't do any discovery for Overcast at all. I just use it for subscribing to the things I find out about elsewhere, if I'm honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't use the built-in Apple Podcast application because it's weird because there's a number of podcasts I listen to that would be ad-free if I listened to them on Apple Podcast, but I still listen to it on Overcast because I've just used it forever. He's a great developer, and I just like supporting it. So
good. Definitely cool. Well, great having you on the show, and
thanks for having me. I really appreciate the time, and definitely point your wife at that Octolamp because it's a good project to build. I tried to make it accessible, and it's all like clicky. Like I've done, there's nice like little inserts and things, so it's just press fit. So you need very little tools to actually assemble it. So it should be good fun.
Well, I think she's more interested in the patterned lights, right? The programmable lights part.
Exactly. So the WLED is the application that you load onto this, and it's a 82 ESP8266. Is it the chip or something? But it's these little wireless, these little WeMOS D1 minis is the chip you use. But yeah, if you expose her to that, she'll be off and go do all sorts of art and all sorts of like amazing LED things. So yeah, it should be
good. What's the interface for programming it like?
There's a web interface for controlling it, and then you send stuff on over. So and then you can, the actual right programs you do is if you want, it's equivalent. You can run this like Arduino hardware, but WLED is a framework project that sits on top of it that gives you a web interface, but it's got a phone app, and you can do all the stuff and makes it really easy to do things. So
because I'm sure the eight-year-old granddaughter is pretty sharp, and I think the two of them would have a great time with that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely would.
Cool. All right.
Cool.
Thanks for
good
coming
on. Take care. Yeah, I appreciate your time.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.